Managing your personal finances.
Never before has there been such a need for sound personal financial management. Today, the average consumer is reeling under the blows of double-digit inflation. More people are now resorting to bankruptcy than during the height of the Great Depression. And for each of the thousands of families that throw in the financial towel, authorities estimate that a dozen more are having dire money troubles. Even though the hidden tax of inflation has taken a sizable bite out of the average consumer's paycheck, he is still materially better off than his predecessors. Compared to 20 years ago, the average American or Western European lived on a vastly improved standard. In little more than 10 years, the median income in the United States has nearly doubled, and until recently, it had managed to outpace a parallel rise in the cost of living. The developed world literally overflows with the trappings of prosperity. Approximately 80% of all U.S. households possess at least one automobile. Many own two and even three vehicles. Two out of three families own their own home. About one in ten of these is equipped with a backyard swimming pool. Nearly all families own at least one black and white television set, and over half own a color model. In spite of this unprecedented prosperity, consumer debt in the United States is at an all-time high. From 1945 to 1970, it mushroomed 22 times over. During the first 6 months of 1974, consumer credit continued to climb at an average rate of $16 billion a day. Today, it stands at a staggering $200 billion, or roughly $940 for every man, woman, and child in the United States. The reasons for this current avalanche of credit aren't too hard to find. It basically got started at the close of World War II, when consumers found themselves facing a dazzling array of material goods that had been denied them during the war. The retail trade industry helped capitalize on their pent-up desire by selling merchandise on temptingly easy credit terms. Little by little, many consumers abandoned the old maxim of pay-as-you-go and embarked on the seemingly painless method of buy now, pay later. A new generation was spawned that thought a penny saved was a penny that really didn't earn. As Hillel Black, author of Buy Now, Pay Later, wrote back in the early 1960s, one cannot avoid the conclusion that a new class, the indigent debtor, is emerging in America. This class is made up of people from all walks of life with a wide variety of incomes who have been overloaded and oversold debts that they are unable to pay. This type of thinking was also aggravated as consumers saw their hard-earned savings progressively evaporate under the onslaught of prolonged periods of post-war inflation. As his buying power shrank, the consumer sought to stay ahead of the game by unloading his shrinking dollars before the price went up again. Often he did this on a long-term credit basis, hoping to pay back his obligations in cheaper currency. The credit explosion was also accelerated by the advent of those little plastic cards that easily found their way into the purses and wallets of millions of Westerners. Almost overnight, the credit card business became big in every sense of the word. From 1969 to 1974, personal credit outstanding on these cards multiplied 3.5 times. By the latter part of 1974, it was pushing the $9 billion mark in the United States alone. Credit cards and various easy money schemes allowed consumers to play the indebtedness game to the hilt, often with tragic results. During 1974, 185,000 people in the United States had their homes seized or liens placed against them. 1 million Americans had their wages garnished. 1.2 million automobiles were repossessed, and approximately 178,000 people filed for bankruptcy. Credit managers reported that delinquency rates on installment loans during the same period were the highest since 1950. Inflation certainly played a part in the increasing numbers of people who found it difficult to meet their financial obligations. But if inflation were the only culprit, one would expect the lower-paid wage earners to be in the greatest financial difficulty. Surprisingly, it's often the more affluent consumer that gets into trouble. The young married couple with children who earns $10,000 to $15,000 a year is the most likely candidate. It is just such middle-income families who are now lining up for help at consumer counseling services throughout the United States. And people in the $50,000 to $60,000 a year category have not been averse to seeking help from these counselors as well. The problem, then, is basically one of financial mismanagement, not necessarily a lack of money. Americans have formed the habit of borrowing and buying without thinking, dutifully turning to the bank, the credit card, or the time payment plan instead of saving and paying cash. One Ohio Credit Bureau manager was quite frank on this lack of wisdom on the part of the average consumer. "We feel that an increasing number of people are not competent to handle credit. In our study locally, we feel that 25% of consumers are unable to handle extensive credit transactions." Sidney Margolius, How to Make the Most of Your Money in New York, Meredith Press, 1969 Preface. It is this lack of knowledge and experience in rightly handling personal finances which is at the bottom of many a family money problem. Most people have been trained as money earners, not spenders. A man may be an expert in running a computer and fail miserably in running a budget. He may be a whiz at managing a supermarket and flop in managing his budget. Few have been taught how to spend money sensibly. The purpose of this booklet, then, is to outline some of the basic principles of sound personal financial management. Each one is a vital key that will help you make the most of your income. Often families find that the totals in their bank accounts are quite depressing because they have an overly inflated concept of what their lifestyle should be. The Time Life Book of Family Finance succinctly described this all-too-common syndrome as follows. Effective management of family finances must proceed from an understanding of the lifestyle into which a family properly fits. Money spent to build an unreal image of what the family is or is trying to be is money wasted, page 53. Keeping up with the Joneses can be a very unprofitable undertaking. The family that fritters away its income on expensive non-essentials may soon be left wondering how the next rent payment is going to be made. Contrast this approach with that of the Apostle Paul in the New Testament. I have learned to be content whatever the circumstances may be. I know now how to live when things are difficult, and I know how to live when things are prosperous. I have learned the secret of facing either plenty or poverty. Philippians 4, verses 11 and 12, J.B. Phillips. Having this kind of attitude about material wealth can save a person many a financial woe. The key is to recognize that whether rich or poor, in debt or out, material possessions do not make one permanently happy. Rather than trying to live beyond his means, he learns to be satisfied with what he has, and improves on it as time and money permit. Using this basic approach, in the next few pages we offer some suggestions on how to trim some of your major living expenses. With food prices setting new records practically every month, many consumers have already become well-versed in the art of trimming down their food budgets. In some instances, they have simply sacrificed on the quality and/or quantity of food consumed. In the face of double-digit inflation, a family may have no other recourse. However, there are ways of getting around the weekly price squeeze at the supermarket. One obvious way to soften the blow of family food prices is to buy in bulk. A smart shopper who stocks up on large economy sizes will save more than just food money. She may eliminate some of those time and gas-consuming trips to the local grocery store. Significant savings can also be achieved by avoiding prepackaged meals or gourmet items. Much of their price represents the cost of somebody else's labor. Potatoes, for instance, offer an excellent example of the savings a non-processed diet brings. In their natural state, potatoes sell for a few cents a pound. Yet they may cost $1 to $2.50 a pound as potato chips or crisps. Natural grains often quadruple in cost when transformed into boxed cereals. And block cheese is another prominent food item that sells much more cheaply than its sliced counterpart. And non-processed food, vegetables, fruits, meats, milk, and grains, are not only usually cheaper, but provide a healthier diet as well. In this regard, you might consider starting a backyard garden. For the price of a few seeds, and perhaps an occasional sore sacroiliac, you can enjoy the pleasures and financial rewards of homegrown produce. Perhaps the biggest food savings a family can achieve will come through home cooking. Restaurant dining, even in more modest establishments, is an expensive proposition. When a family dines out, they in effect are paying a heavy premium to have somebody else prepare their meal. Shopping in supermarkets that don't offer trading stamps can also shave a few dollars off the monthly bill. While you may think the merchandise you eventually get at the redemption center makes up for the higher prices, it really doesn't. Otherwise, the people in the food stamp business would have gone broke years ago. Efficient meal planning can also be a boon to the family food budget. Leftovers can be tastefully recycled in the form of casseroles, soups, or stews. And on weekends, you might try serving two meals a day instead of three. This might be more convenient for the family that rises late on Saturday and Sunday mornings. Slavishly following the latest fads may look chic, but it's not so fashionable when it comes time to pay the clothing bills. Your clothing budget can stay in trim if you basically stick to apparel that is classic and timeless in style. Buying quality clothing is another way you can save dollars in the long run, even though you may have to shell out a few more bills at the time of purchase. If a wife is a good seamstress, she can rack up significant savings on her own sewing machine. On the other hand, for certain types of apparel, a stitch at home may not always be worth the time, effort, and cost of the material involved. Since the clothing industry is highly competitive, it pays to shop around. If your family financing is such that you can time your purchases to coincide with seasonal sales, so much the better. And don't rule out quality used clothing. In some big cities, fashion-conscious females will unload a once or twice worn garment in a resale store. There it can be purchased at a fraction of its original cost. What's good for General Motors may in some instances be good for America, but it's not always good for the average consumer. Turning over the family auto every 2 or 3 years is a losing financial game. If you want to get the most for your transportation dollar, first resolve not to get caught up in the game of musical cars. Hang on to the old buggy for a while. Get some mileage out of it if you can. That sleek and shiny new vehicle that looks so good in the showroom will usually depreciate $1,000 in value the minute you sign the papers and put the key in the ignition. After the first couple of years, depreciation drops off a bit, so you can come out somewhat ahead of the game if you hold on to a new car for at least 4 to 5 years. After that point in time, depending on how bad its planned obsolescence factor is, you may find the cost of repairs and operation greater than the cost of making a trade. If you can find the type of car that you can buy new and operate economically for 10 years or more, you will be well ahead of the automaker's shell game. And if you can pay cash on the barrel head, you can save yourself a bundle in costly auto finance charges. Obviously, the compacts and subcompacts are a definite plus for the new car buyer who is looking for economy. Why fork over extra money and gasoline for a 5,000-pound behemoth for mom to drive to the corner grocery? That kind of sledgehammer to kill a gnat routine hardly makes sense in today's tight economy. And watch those options like air conditioning, automatic transmission, and power-assisted systems. They not only add to the cost of the car, but subtract from its economical operation as well. Nor does it hurt to learn a little something about auto mechanics. Often you can save yourself sizable repair bills by doing your own routine maintenance, such as tune-ups, oil changes, and the like. And if you are really fed up with shelling out money for the operation of the family auto, you might think about riding a bicycle, public transit, or carpooling. Most families spend 8 to 10% of their annual income on health care. The family following natural health laws might easily cut this amount in half. Drugs are tremendously high-priced because of the public's overwhelming demand to feel good. In a way, we are paying for the pharmacist's college education, the doctor's MD, and the advertising campaign of the company that produces the drug in question. It would be a lot smarter and more economical to concentrate on a health-conscious style of living. A little concern spent on preventive maintenance, a scheduled check on the car, the window screens, the washer, the stove, the roof, the bicycle, and so on, can mean a lot of money saved on expensive repair bills. Polishing shoes the right way, learning how to remove spots from rugs and tablecloths, using pads for hot things, using coasters on glasses and cups so rings won't be left, wiping your feet when you come in the door. The list is practically innumerable and involves everything we own and use. Unless you have tried family budgeting, you probably won't like it. But once you jump in, you may find the waters of household financial planning aren't as cold and austere as you thought they were. Most people make the mistake of thinking of budgeting as a record of money spent. They often go bananas trying to keep track of their expenditures down to the last nickel and dime. Frustrated by such fruitless experiences, they look with jaundiced eye upon the idea of juggling figures. What they fail to realize is that budgeting plans for future financial events, not past ones. Budgetary planning can sometimes work wonders for the family that normally limps along using sloppy or haphazard bookkeeping methods. It can take some of the sting out of the rising cost of living. It will enable a couple to find the loopholes in their spending habits. It can often help a family establish a guideline for its spending priorities, and it can provide timely data on the current state of the household economy. But proper budgeting can't be done with a lick and a promise type of approach. It is a systematic, well-documented process that is designed to eliminate the monthly nightmare of trying to figure out how you are going to pay the next bill. The technique many families use today is to pay whatever bills have come in since the last check with whatever money is on hand. This is not really budgeting. It is frustrated money juggling. First of all, sit down and make a comprehensive list of all debts and expenses you ordinarily have over a period of time. Don't forget long-term objectives such as future educational expenses, a new car, and so on. You may want to set aside a certain amount each month toward fulfilling these financial goals. Normally, the most convenient period to use is a year in order to include items such as insurance or taxes. Last year's bills are a good guide to help make estimates. Guess if you have to, but don't miss anything. Missed items, unless minor, will break the budget when they're due. Then adjust each and every bill to the length of time between your paychecks. If, for example, you are paid twice a month, then monthly bills will have to be divided in half and weekly bills doubled. A yearly bill should be divided into 24 parts. All other bills will have to be similarly adjusted. This now provides a basic spending schedule of how to handle each check or pay packet as it comes in. For example, to pay a $200 per month rent bill from a weekly pay period, set aside $50 from each paycheck. In England, the figures might be £10 per week for a £40 monthly rent. If you handle all expenses in this manner, you should spend all paychecks almost identically. In other words, each time you get a check, your list will tell you exactly how much to put away for future expense. Then you will have precisely what you need to pay the bills as they arrive. By saving up for bills from each check, the worry of budgeting disappears. No longer do you have the agony of matching each bill to a specific paycheck month after month. There are some records that you will have to keep, but not many, and they are not that difficult. You could use double or triple entry ledger paper from the local stationery shop, or you might prefer one of the many commercially prepared budget record books. Even an ordinary notebook with ruled vertical lines is completely satisfactory. Designate one page for each broad category of yearly expense. About a dozen categories is enough. If you have too many categories, the amount of record keeping becomes excessive and budgeting will become burdensome. Each page is like an ordinary checkbook register for each category. On it, show deposits and withdrawals. As each paycheck comes in, the deposits are made according to the basic spending schedule as calculated above. The withdrawals take place when the bills come in. The money itself can be kept in a lump sum in a bank account. Or you might draw up a master expenditure schedule on one page that would include deposits and withdrawals for all categories. Otherwise, you can convert your paychecks into cash and divide into envelopes the predetermined amount for each category. However, you may find trying to keep track of cash in a number of different envelopes a rather cumbersome process. Most may find some combination of the above methods the best compromise. The check system works best for normal pay-by-mail bills. The cash system works best for those items you normally pay with cash, especially money the wife spends for food and household items. Entertainment and pocket money would also fit into this category. No record in the book need be made for money kept in cash. The cash in the separate envelope serves the same function as the entries in the book. Extreme care should be used in keeping this cash in a confidential place, away from children and neighbors. Once established, the method of budgeting just described provides two substantial benefits that lead to the fundamental solution of most people's budget inadequacies. First, it takes away the bookkeeping brain work. This alone is enough to keep many from even trying to budget. Secondly, it exerts a powerful brake on irresponsible spending. What's more, with this budget, you can know that you are not forgetting any items or wasting any money. Not only this, but the greatest blessing is the freedom it gives you when spending the money. If you have carefully and faithfully set aside the money from each paycheck to pay each bill, you will be able to spend it with the complete knowledge that it was intended for that purpose. You will know that it might not have been better spent elsewhere, and where this becomes a rare joy is in money spent on luxuries. Whatever a budget is, it should be a family affair. Unless the husband and wife cooperate and work together, few budgets will work. If both charge items on different credit cards and separate bank accounts, for example, financial catastrophe can occur. If a family is going to tighten its financial belt to get out of debt, it cannot be an arbitrary decision. Both husband and wife must agree to it. The wife should play a big part in family finances. She should know how the family income is spent. Her opinion should count heavily. Friction and trouble can and will arise unless her views are fully considered. Whatever is done, it should be done with the consent of both. Psychologists and home economists agree that sharing financial duties promotes family harmony. It builds stronger family ties in every way. A budget is also a tremendous way for children to learn many of the principles of financial management. Why not allocate certain amounts, however small, to each of your children to teach them to live within their means? Your children, properly taught the value of hard-earned money, will be much better prepared for adulthood and their own financial responsibilities. Give them an allowance regularly, even though it be small, and teach them how to use that money properly. It is a lesson of character they will appreciate when they grow up. Credit, in many ways, is like alcohol. It's easy to get hooked on if it's not used in moderation. Sometimes the only solution for the creditaholic is to go cold turkey until his financial system has a chance to return to equilibrium. This in no way implies that the use of credit per se is wrong. On the business level, the proper use of credit has significantly facilitated the flow of goods and services. long-term, low-interest loans have made it possible for individuals to purchase items such as homes or automobiles that would otherwise have required the accumulation of many years' savings. Another credit mechanism, the credit card, has been a tremendous boon to the consumer who is temporarily low on cash. It has eliminated the danger of carrying large amounts of currency, especially during prolonged periods of travel. And credit cards provide a convenient form of identification when cashing checks or renting cars. But buying on credit can be a financial curse as well as a convenience, particularly when a person gets behind on his payments. Credit buying often creates the illusion of prosperity. The small size of the monthly installment, its delayed arrival at the end of the month, and the lack of cash at the time of purchase make the goodies of life seem suddenly within reach. As one young serviceman commented, "Sometimes, when you save and wait too long, the good things you want to get might pass you by." But this kind of unsound reasoning is causing millions of families with otherwise adequate incomes to spend their paychecks before they even receive them. Once you get caught in the credit trap, to the extent that your free money is being spent on installment payments, you're doing the same thing as saving the money, only at a cost. The money you would have in your savings account is now going to a credit institution. In effect, you are paying a premium in order to own something now instead of later. If credit is habitually used in this manner, it can often turn out to be an expensive proposition. Most credit cards, revolving charge accounts, and automatic overdraft facilities usually require a minimum monthly interest charge of 1.5% on the outstanding balance. This can easily add up to a whopping 18 to 20% a year, some charge even more. But that's only part of the cost of credit. Sometimes interest charges on credit purchases will be computed from the first of the month, even though the actual purchase may not have occurred at that time. In effect, the customer is being charged interest during a period of time in which he did not have use of the merchandise bought on credit. Or take the case of simple annual interest rates. Say you borrow $100 at 10% annual interest. You contract to pay back both principal and interest within the next 12 months. Your finance charge then is $10. But here's the kicker. You don't have the full use of the $100 for the entire year. You will be paying back principal and interest in 12 installments at roughly $9 a month. After 6 months, you've paid back approximately $54, which means you'll have only about $46 left. As time goes on, net cash on hand will become progressively smaller. A little figuring will reveal that the average amount of money you actually possessed during the 12-month period was something less than $50, yet you paid interest based on the entire $100 amount. Shopping with cash, on the other hand, can often save the consumer more than just monthly carrying charges. The man or woman who pays cash can sometimes buy at a discount. The cash-conscious consumer can also take advantage of seasonal sales. He's able to shop around more freely and buy where his money has the most purchasing power. The individual operating on credit is often forced to purchase where he has his charge account, even though a sale may be going on next door. Solomon wisely perceived that the rich rules over the poor and the borrower is servant to the lender, Proverbs 22:7. A cash basis of financial management, at least for a time, is a good way to learn how to avoid this type of financial bondage. The question therefore logically arises, where do I start? The average money manager first should realize that there are two types of family and personal expenses. Rex Wilder, in the popular Macmillan Guide to Family Finances, identifies them as wants and needs. A need, he defines as a desire of great urgency, very often a biological necessity, such as food and shelter. A want, he views as a desire of little urgency, set in motion by no basic necessity. In today's society, credit buying for needs, such as a car or a home, can be looked on as a necessity. Even these purchases, however, can sometimes be delayed until more cash is available to lessen the finance charges. On the other hand, credit should rarely be used for wants. Families in trouble have frequently used too much credit on wants rather than on what they really needed. Until they can accumulate savings, they should adopt a policy of buying wants, such as TV sets, sporting goods, or excess furniture, strictly on a cash basis. Here's why. Saving cash for luxuries or wants exerts a remarkably stabilizing influence on a family's monetary policy. By the time you've saved the needed cash, there will be little doubt in your mind whether you can afford the item or if, in fact, you still really want it. To use this approach, you must resolve not to purchase anything more on credit until your accounts are all paid in full. At least limit the credit purchases during your transition period to an absolute minimum so that you can get your credit accounts paid off at the earliest possible date. Then, instead of immediately obligating yourself to more payments by purchasing additional articles, let your savings accumulate until such time as you can begin to buy these items for cash. Remember, the wise family can learn to live with credit, but it should never live by it. A few years ago, the average wage earner could confidently entrust his surplus income to a savings account and expect to receive his own, along with a sizable amount of interest a few years hence. Now, double-digit inflation has changed all this. Even though interest rates have generally tended to rise over the years, they've been fighting a losing battle with the rising cost of living. For instance, consider the case of John Doe, diligent wage earner. He deposited $1,000 in his local savings loan in 1967. Let's assume John got a yearly yield of 5% on his investment. After 7 years, John's ready to withdraw his little nest egg. He walks out of the savings institution clutching a cashier's check for $1,407. His original investment of $1,000 has grown almost half again in size. But wait a minute. John forgot about the rising cost of living. Every dollar he earned in 1967 has lost approximately 30 cents worth of purchasing power. His $1,407 has shrunk to $978 in terms of 1974 prices. John actually lost ground to inflation even though his money was gaining interest. John's case is typical of many a middle and lower income wage earner in the Western world. And the sad part is that when inflation rages unchecked as it has over the last few years, virtually everyone in John's category is going to come out a loser to one degree or another. However, there are limited investment options available that can ease some of the pain of inflation, maximize yield, and provide a good secure haven for a family's capital. You can, for instance, achieve higher than normal interest yields if you're willing to deposit a minimum amount of money with a bank or savings and loan institution for at least 2 to 5 years. And if you have $5,000 at your disposal, a certificate of deposit purchased through a bank will return even larger interest rates. Government securities, such as treasury bills, also have traditionally been sold at higher rates of return than regular savings and loan accounts. Money market mutual funds are another fairly safe investment structured along the same lines. However, in both of these cases, you again need a minimum basic amount, usually $1,000, before you can invest. How about the stock market? Even if you know what you are doing in today's troubled economy, you can still get burned, and burned badly. The dropping Dow Jones of the early and middle 70s certainly bears eloquent testimony to this fact. In the last few years, Wall Street has become primarily the domain of the big institutional investors, who supposedly, but not always, know which way the winds of economic change are blowing. In such a world of financial giants, the little investor is at a decided disadvantage. Usually, he's the last to find out that his stock is about to take a nosedive. Long before he can even think about unloading, the big boys have long since cashed in their chips in the face of an impending slide. Sidney Margolius, a leading family financial advisor, detailed the problem in his book, The Innocent Investor in the Shaky Ground Floor. Even worse, he, the small investor, lacks access to the same degree or quality of investment research that large investors can command. To many stockbrokers, he's a nuisance. Nor does he have the ability to move quickly to grasp intermediate trends or get out of the way of disaster. In fact, so notorious is the tardiness of the small investor that professional speculators often regard his decisions as a signal to do the opposite. On page 22. This is not to say the stock market is a bad investment haven per se. Often small investors have done quite well through judicious purchases of stock. Mutual funds carry the same inherent risks, although to a somewhat lesser degree. However, the mutuals have one marked disadvantage over stocks, more expensive sales commissions. In certain types of funds, this charge can run as high as 10% of the amount being invested. If you have read some of the popular economic works of the last few years, like How to Prepare for the Coming Crash or How You Can Profit from the Coming Devaluation, you may have wondered about the advisability of purchasing gold as a hedge against inflation. The authors of such volumes would have the reader believe that gold is the ultimate financial refuge in a world of economic instability. But is gold really all that much of a glittering investment? First of all, there is no more volatile investment than gold. Prices can change radically and dramatically and in any direction overnight. Even professional dealers and investors in gold are oftentimes totally surprised by the whims and caprice of the world gold markets. There is also no other market with more shady operators looking for a fast killing than in gold and coins for the numismatic value. Many gold coin dealers have gone bankrupt in recent times, taking their investors' money with them. Even in periods of relatively steady market, gold will remain at best an unpredictable investment that pays no dividends, earns no interest, and must be kept safe at no small cost to the investor. The real attraction in buying gold is the hope of a quick turnover, meaning a large capital gain. But with brokers' commission fees ranging in the neighborhood of 10% if one buys and sells, and with 10% a year plus storage costs, the price of gold would have to increase at least 20% in 1 year before the investor would even break even. If the individual decides to forego paying the storage fees and maintain his gold privately, he will have to pay assay costs when he resells it. This can amount to an additional $30 to $100. In view of such difficulties, it's no wonder the American Bankers Association warned that individuals who may feel lured by the glitter of gold should remember that the yellow commodity does not pay dividends, is costly and difficult to transport and store, may not find ready buyers, and could be the subject of international speculation. Gold coins offer similar problems. Coins are more easily counterfeited and can be more easily stolen. A recent edition of Forbes magazine reported that some authorities estimate dealers overgrade fully half of all coins sold in order to get anywhere from 50% to 300% more for them than they are really worth. Forbes went on to report that counterfeiting is at epidemic proportions, infecting even occasional bags of gold coins shipped here from Swiss banks. Between fakes and overgraded coins, the average trusting buyer runs a better than even chance of being rooked, if not robbed, to rent or to buy. This is probably the biggest investment question the average family will face during its lifetime. There are no simple answers. The decision is ultimately based on individual family financial circumstances, lifestyle, and residential preferences. There's much to be said for either alternative. The renter, for instance, is free from many of the financial obligations a homeowner normally incurs. If he's laid off or loses his job, he doesn't have to wrestle with mortgage payments during his period of unemployment. He's free from the worry and expense of home maintenance, chores, and property taxes. And he's in a much more flexible position when it comes to moving or changing job locations. The homeowner, on the other hand, enjoys a few financial breaks the average renter is denied. While his monthly mortgage payments may be a little steeper, he usually reaps considerable savings when it comes time to pay income taxes because of deductions allowed for interest payments and property taxes. The interest rates a homeowner pays on his loan are also offset by the rising cost of living. As time goes on, he'll be repaying his loan with cheaper dollars. And if the value of his property keeps pace with the yearly rise in the cost of living, the homeowner has in effect hedged his original investment against the long-term effects of inflation. Once a homeowner signs a mortgage, he has two other advantages over the renter. He doesn't have to worry about having his monthly payments inflated. And given enough time, he'll begin to build up a bit of equity in his property. Unfortunately, many prospective buyers sometimes bite off more house than they can chew. Consequently, they sometimes end up on emergency rations during their first few years of tenure. The traditional rule of thumb used by most financial experts engaging a prospective buyer's ability to meet mortgage obligations is: 1. The house should not cost more than 2.5, now as high as 3, times a buyer's annual take-home pay, and 2. His payments should not exceed 1/4 of his monthly income. Fluctuating interest rates should also be watched closely. Often a prospective home buyer can reap substantial savings if he makes his move when interest rates are low. Build up your savings. Before embarking on an investment program, you should at least maintain some type of viable savings account that can be drawn on for two purposes, planned and emergency expenditures. This may be difficult during times of severe inflation, but it is essential to your overall family financial stability. In fact, you might want to consider subdividing your savings into separate accounts to cover each of these categories. The first type, known as operational savings, would go for the planned expenditures such as maternity bills, winter clothing, major appliances, and the like. For example, you may find you can afford to save for a stereo set. Set up a fund called your stereo fund. Put in what you can afford from each paycheck, either weekly, semi-monthly, or whatever fits your pay cycle. The time will come when you can purchase the item with cash, and having cash, you might find a real bargain on a new model. A financial buffer. The second kind of savings provides for totally unexpected, unpredictable emergencies. It's not for specific future needs like a vacation, a new household appliance, or retirement. It is reserve savings, a built-in safety valve for your budget. When you begin to accumulate funds in such a reserve, leave them alone except for genuine emergencies. Then, when your reserve is reduced because of some mishap, build it back with the same diligence as before. You will be surprised how much further it will make the rest of your money go. In the preceding pages of this booklet, we've described some of the principles of wise money management. It might seem that if one followed these, he would be a financial success, yet many have followed these principles and still have fallen short of real success. There's another principle governing the success or failure of your financial matters that is more important in the long run than those already mentioned. It comes from one of the least recognized sources of financial information, the Bible. Many businessmen have regularly searched the pages of the Bible for guidance in their daily affairs. They have found that the Bible has many practical words of advice, especially to the money handler. Consider, for example, the biblical principle of savings. Go to the ant, thou sluggard, consider her ways and be wise, which having no guide, overseer, or ruler, provides her meat in the summer and gathers her food in the harvest. Proverbs 6, verses 6 through 8. A deeper and more profound monetary concept is contained in the words of Jesus Christ. It is more blessed to give than to receive. Acts 20, verse 35. Admittedly, it is not easy to give when you're short on cash yourself. But once a person begins to use some of his resources to help others, he discovers he's begun to lose some of his selfish attitudes. This principle of concern for others exerts a far greater stabilizing influence on a person than the other points mentioned previously in this booklet. The book of Proverbs expresses the principle in this way. It is possible to give away and become richer. It is also possible to hold on too tightly and lose everything. Yes, the liberal man shall be rich. By watering others, he waters himself. Proverbs 11, verses 24 and 25, the Living Bible. Thousands have had their lives vastly changed for the better by the biblical principle of tithing. They have found that it works. Look at it this way. Everything produced, money and the things money will buy, comes from the earth. Humanity didn't make the earth. God did. We merely apply energy and thinking and planning and labor while on the earth, which God created and owns. Where does the energy we expend really come from? It too comes from God. We merely utilize what God supplies. Therefore, God has a prior claim of ownership on all we take for granted that we produce. His claim is valid. But God is concerned about humanity. He has our interest and welfare in mind. He has set laws in motion for our benefit, regulating that portion of his wealth which our thinking and our labor extracted from the earth and developed. God's principle, regulating what you earn, can be likened to a contract. He allows humanity to work on his earth, to use a part of the earth for food and other materials for our livelihood, to utilize its soil, its timber, its water, its coal and oil, and to manufacture products from it. In turn, God wants us to understand that we are working with him in partnership, maintaining and developing what he created. The record of that financial partnership can be traced back to the earliest beginnings of man's sojourn on this earth. The first man, Adam, was instructed to dress and keep the Garden of Eden, Genesis 2:15. His descendant, Abraham, was educated in all the commandments, laws, and statutes regarding man's relationship to God, himself, and the earth. The biblical record states that Abraham obeyed God's voice, and kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws, Genesis 26:5. Consider one of these pre-Mosaic principles that Abraham was apparently taught. It's recorded in Genesis 14. A confederation of four kings invaded the flourishing cities of Sodom and Gomorrah and took Lot, Abraham's nephew, captive, verses 11 and 12. Subsequently, Abraham blitzed these four kings in battle, rescuing Lot as well as recovering all the booty taken from these twin cities. En route to his home, Abraham met Melchizedek, king of Salem and priest of the Most High God. He then gave Melchizedek tithes, or a tenth, of all the spoils, including non-agricultural products, verses 18 through 20. Check also Hebrews 7, verse 4. There are several interesting observations that can be drawn from this account. The main one is this. The spoils clearly belonged to Abraham. In a strict sense, according to the custom of war, Abraham was entitled to all won in battle by right of conquest. But not wanting his wealth traceable to any man, he returned everything except a full tenth and what his young men needed for provisions. Genesis 14, verses 23 and 24. The crucial point is that he gave the tithe to Melchizedek before disposition to any other parties.
Abraham's grandson, Jacob, was involved in the other recorded pre-Mosaic tithing incident mentioned in Genesis. Jacob was running for his life from his brother Esau. During his flight, God promised Jacob both land and an innumerable host of descendants. Genesis 28, verses 13 through 15. In a positive response to these promises, Jacob vowed a vow, saying, "If God will be with me, and will keep me in this way that I go, and will give me bread to eat, and raiment to put on, so that I come again to my father's house in peace, then shall the Lord be my God." Verses 20 and 21. Then Jacob continued with a little-known second promise to his Creator, "And of all that thou give me, I will surely give the tenth unto thee." Verse 22. Genesis 31, verses 3, 13, 18 through 20, and Genesis 35, verses 1 and 6 through 7, show that Jacob fulfilled the first part of this vow to worship God. In that light, it would be highly inconceivable for Jacob not to have fulfilled the second half of his promise as well, a promise to tithe on all the future increase that God would give him. Presumably, this would mean that Jacob would have had to tithe more than one time, since he would not have received all of his God-given sustenance at once. Apart from these two specific accounts, tithing is not again discussed until incorporated into Mosaic law. Here it is discussed as an ongoing law, not one established at Mount Sinai. See Numbers 18:21. Moses had stated, "All the tithe of the land is the Lord's. It is holy unto the Lord." Leviticus 27:30. However, although the tithe belonged to the Lord, he designated it for Levitical and priestly use at that time. "I have given the children of Levi all the tenth in Israel for an inheritance." Numbers 18:21. Now, for the sake of space, we pick up the story hundreds of years after Moses, following the return of a few tribes to the Holy Land after the Babylonian captivity. The temple services flourished as long as the Israelites performed their responsibility in paying the tithe diligently. It was a time of exciting restoration, a spiritual renaissance for the Jewish people of that time. Once the initial zeal wore off, however, the situation in post-captivity Judah began to deteriorate. Priests became politically oriented and contemptuous of the temple services, haphazard in their selection of sacrificial animals. God gave them a scathing indictment through the prophet Malachi. "But ye, the priests, are departed out of the way. Ye have caused many to stumble at the law. Ye have corrupted the covenant of Levi, saith the Lord of hosts." Malachi 2:8. He pointed to the track record of forsaking his ordinances and laws since the nation's infancy in the wilderness. Malachi 3:7. God appealed to the nation to return to real worship of him. Then, when the people asked God just what he meant, the Creator replied, "Will a man rob God? Yet ye have robbed me. But ye say, wherein have we robbed thee? In tithes and offerings. Ye are cursed with a curse, for ye have robbed me, even this whole nation." Verses 8 and 9. By not paying the Levites the tenth, the people were actually robbing God. But was the message of Malachi only for the people of his day? The prophetic context of this tithing passage indicates that the message, indeed the tithing principle, was also for a future time. Skipping over the period from Malachi to Matthew, we now enter the New Testament dispensation. In Matthew 23, Jesus Christ, a New Testament prophet, indicted the religious leaders of his day for their upside-down priorities concerning God's way of life. "Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! For ye pay tithe of mint and anise and cumin, and have omitted the weightier matters of the law, judgment, mercy, and faith. These ought ye to have done, and not to leave the other, tithing, undone." Verse 23. So Jesus of Nazareth did endorse the tithing principle, even when applied to something as small as the increase from a backyard herb garden. Another biblical passage helps to clarify this important verse in its context. Notice the very first verse of this chapter. "Then spake Jesus to the multitude and to his disciples, saying, The scribes and the Pharisees sit in Moses' seat, etc." Apparently Matthew 23 was directed to the general populace and Christ's own special students, as well as the scribes and Pharisees. At any rate, Jesus' own words do appear to sustain the tithing principle. Considering the foregoing material, how should 20th century man approach the subject of tithing? It is important that man recognize God as the owner, proprietor, and creator of everything we observe in the natural environment. "The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, the world and they that dwell therein." Psalm 24:1, Psalm 50, verses 10 and 11, Job 41:11, Deuteronomy 10:14, Exodus 19:5, and so on. And this includes the rare metals often employed as basic monetary standards and mediums of exchange. The silver is mine, and the gold is mine, says the Eternal of Hosts, Haggai 2, verse 8. These passages and others show that God owns his creation, including man, and there is no possible way humanity can begin to reimburse the Creator for all of his beneficence. The gift of life itself is precious beyond words. Then there's land, water, air, and all the things of the earth that go to make life so enjoyable for humanity. See Matthew 5:45. And as the psalmist wrote, "Blessed be the Lord, who daily loadeth us with benefits." Psalm 68:19. He knew that the Creator was a giving God. Tithing, indeed the giving principle, shows our respect, love, and admiration for our Creator. It is an expression of honor and acknowledgement of God's supreme lordship and mastery in the universe. A very wise king certainly captured the principle of this giving spirit in Proverbs 3, verses 9 and 10. Honor the Lord with thy substance, and with the first fruit of all thine increase. So shall thy barns be filled with plenty, and thy presses shall burst out with new wine. Emergency method of getting out of debt. Even though you start now to live within your means and to buy absolutely nothing else on credit, and though you budget payments to gradually retire all your previous debts, that alone may not be the full solution if you're heavily in debt. Why? Because while you may be able to repay $10 to $20 or more a month, with debts totaling $1, $2, $3, $4, $5, or $6,000 or more, you won't be out of debt for another 5 to 10 years. Debt years are depressing years, with family arguments often resulting from the financial strain. Life is too precious and too short to attempt to live under the burden of debt for years and years. First figure how much monthly income, that's income available after you pay for food, shelter, and transportation, you would have if you had no debts. Then total up all your debt payments, including interest and finance charges, and subtract that figure from your disposable income. If the difference is a negative figure, you're over your head in debt. The only way you're going to get back in the black is to cut your standard of living to a state of emergency level. By going on an emergency basis, most people can be completely out of debt in a year or two at the most. Scrutinize all your expenses. Look for ways to make emergency cuts in spending in order to live far below your present income. Decide what you can cut out entirely. Really sacrifice. The more you sacrifice now, the sooner you will be really happy. Consider your car first. Ask yourself if you could possibly get along without it. A car could cost you as much as it costs to support a child. So it might be a good idea to get rid of your car if you can possibly do without it. Perhaps for a few dollars a month, you can ride to work with a fellow employee. Maybe you could even walk or ride a bus or bicycle. The money you get for your car and the amount you will not be spending for its operation every month will go a long way in helping you get out of debt a lot sooner. You might also be able to move to an area closer to your job where there's a store within walking distance. Be careful, of course, to consider the crime and violence situation of a potential economy neighborhood. Financially, you might benefit greatly, but in the long run, it could be a very bad human bargain. You could conceivably cut your rent $20 to $50 a month by renting a less expensive house. Paint and elbow grease are not very expensive. A temporary economy house can be made very livable and attractive with a little cleaning, paint, and inexpensive curtains. Now consider your food bill. While you must provide for adequate nutrition, you probably can accomplish it for much less money. Buying food on sale and in quantities when possible will save money. You can also save by baking bread, and the whole family can help in planting a garden. Cheaper cuts of meat will do just as well as the more expensive ones. You can completely eliminate that which is not essential to maintaining good health. You will find many other ways to save if you really put your mind to it. It's not too much to do in an emergency, and it can be fun. You and your family can make a game out of it. Recreation can become a family picnic at a nearby park rather than dinner at a restaurant. Games at home and family conversation are cheaper than commercial entertainment and probably far better for you emotionally. An occasional trip to the mountains or seashore is possible with another family that can afford a car. If you're having trouble making monthly payments, by all means, let your creditors know. To them, any news from you is better than no news at all. Most creditors will bend over backwards to work things out as long as they have any hope of recovering their debts. Almost anything is better than resigning 50% of the amount to a collection agency or maybe recovering nothing at all. Generally, avoid debt consolidation loans. Usually, you end up paying through the nose in exorbitant interest charges. However, you can sometimes come out ahead with low-interest credit union or life insurance loans. If the wife isn't working, she might consider a part-time or even full-time job if she's not responsible for small children. This may help ease the family financial pains during its austere period. And don't be too proud to seek help from reputable credit counseling organizations. They can often assist you in coming up with a viable plan for paying off your creditors. But whatever plan you adopt, don't give up after a month or two. Set your will, determined to stick with it. Seeing your debts melt away month after month will be worth all the effort and sacrifice. An Intelligent Shopper's Guide to Credit. Read the fine print before you sign. Often unwary credit customers get caught by subtle stipulations buried in the text of the contract. Watch for balloon payments. You may think your monthly installments are a snap until the final one comes due. Then you are required to fork over a gigantic balloon payment in order to meet the terms of the contract. Look for acceleration clauses. Under an acceleration clause, if you miss one payment, your creditor has the right to demand that you automatically pay up on all the outstanding balance. Stagger your purchases. Never attempt to purchase more than one major appliance at a time using credit. Avoid flipping. If you are having trouble making payments on a particular contract, your creditor may want you to refinance the total cost of your outstanding installments, interest charges, and any late payment penalties. If you succumb to such a scheme, you will end up paying interest on top of interest before you ever see the light of day. Minimize the risk of repossession. Under some contracts, you aren't legally considered the owner of the merchandise until the final payment is made. If you default on a payment, your creditor can repossess the items purchased and you end up a two-time loser. You can avoid this kind of traumatic takeover by dealing with a bank and signing a mortgage agreement. Then if you get into any difficulties, you at least have the benefit of due process and legal foreclosure proceedings. Make the interest system work for you. The best way to use a credit card is simply pay back the entire amount on the first installment. That way you avoid any interest on the unpaid balance. Or by timing your purchases, you sometimes can avoid making the first payment for 30 to 50 days. Sometimes a passbook loan will enable you to draw interest on your savings in order to defray the interest charges on your loan. Better yet, use your savings to make the purchase and avoid the finance charges altogether. When you do this, make sure you don't drain your savings account below the minimum level needed for emergencies. Credit danger signals. You may be in financial hot water when: number one, your monthly installment payments, not including home mortgage, soak up more than 20% of your after-tax paycheck. Number two, you have to take out a new loan to refinance old debts. Number three, your total debts exceed the amount you have in savings.
And with that, we complete the reading of Managing Your Personal Finances. Your reader has been Garland Snuffer.